We're here at Menards Bag Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint.
Batteries.
Tools.
Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste, cereal, coffee, dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Don't you think it's about time for a podcast that's more fulfilling? One that's about the vibrant exchange of ideas and perspectives that happens when we actually come together. We got you covered.
Welcome to the Deep Blue Project,
where the depths of conversation meet the waves of personal experience. This is a real, raw, and unscripted show about everything from leadership lessons to self-awareness, wellness, and the latest current events. We cover it all. We have a rotating cast of guests as we share our personal stories, insights, and opinions on the issues that matter most. Plus, we have a blast while doing it.
The Deep Blue Project. It's not just a podcast, it's an experience. And now your host, Chris Workman.
Welcome to this episode of the Deep Blue Project. I am so happy to have with us today Ernie Stevens, who is known pretty much for his documentary, Ernie and Joe, The Crisis Cops. If you haven't seen it, we're going to talk about it here today. So welcome, Ernie, welcome.
Yeah, Chris, honored to be here, man. Thank you for having me on as a guest.
I am so excited, and I appreciate you taking the time out to be with us today. I know you spent a lot of years with the San Antonio Police Department and a lot with the crisis intervention training, so I think that's where we're going to kick off today, and just let us know how you kind of got into that when you got started.
Yeah, so not your typical response, where I was very excited to go to this new training, right? In fact, it was quite the opposite. I was assigned to a tactical response unit, a proactive team for the San Antonio Police Department, where really our focus was going into areas of town that showed a high propensity of violence, drugs, gangs, things like that, and really try to target some of that violence. And at roll call one evening on my day off, a supervisor was looking for some volunteers to go to crisis intervention training. And this was 2003. Nobody had really heard of it yet. And, but interesting enough, if you're in police work and you work overnights, you know that a training opportunity means that you get to sleep in your own bed, some training during the day, actually get to see your family. So my partner, who was at work, did sign me up for the training. And I came back to work the next night. My supervisor said, "Hey, heads up, you'll be in training Monday. You'll have Saturday, Sunday off going into the weekend." I'm like, "Okay, what training am I going to?" And he said, "Well, it's crisis intervention training." I'd never heard of it. I'm like, "Well, that sounds kind of cool, like crisis intervention. Like, what is that?" He goes, "I'll read the bulletin." You know, kind of. So I go over to the bulletin. I find it. And it talks about how we are going to collaborate with our local mental health authority and learn about all the different types of mental health diagnoses, the resources, de-escalation techniques. And I'm looking at this going, who signed me up for this? Like, no. In fact, to be completely transparent with you, Chris, the calls that I tried to avoid the most were calls involving mental health. And I don't say that, despairingly. I say that because I didn't receive any training in the academy at that time. I went through the academy in 1994. Well, 92 was my first academy. I went through a second one with San Antonio in 94, and there was no training in mental health and how to fill out the involuntary commitment forms, nothing. So you learned from your field training officers as you got these calls, right? And I can remember getting these calls for mental health crises and being completely unprepared. And, you know, looking at my field training officer, like, what do we do? And like, just shine a light on the house, tell them everything's okay. And call back if you need anything. And I'm like, okay, if that's what we're supposed to do, right? So the training that I was getting just in the field was less than subpar. It was ridiculous. In fact, to be honest with you, again, if your family called for a mental health crisis and I showed up, I was probably going to do your family a disservice. And it's not because I wanted to, it's because I didn't know how to properly respond and what resources were available to me. So to say all that, I couldn't get out of the training. My name had been turned into accounting and I had to show up. Another interesting fact was when I showed up for the training, one, it was being taught by the Houston Police Department. They had to come down to San Antonio because we didn't have this training yet. And they partnered with some of our local resources, our local mental health authority, and some subject matter experts when it came to some of the courses. But the officers that were invited to attend were from all different agencies, not just San Antonio. So, you know, I was sitting by some, you know, maybe a sheriff on one side that I didn't know, and another officer from another municipality that I didn't know. That the training was at a church. It was just, it was very awkward. The whole setup was awkward. And it was a week-long class. And I'm looking at the agenda. They hand me this giant workbook when I walk in. I'm like, man, what did I get into? And then I look at the schedule, and I'm seeing role plays every afternoon. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, what? You know, every officer asks, what time is lunch and what time are we getting out? And that was me. So that was my first introduction into crisis intervention training. And it wasn't until Thursday of a week-long class that I had my aha moment of why I truly belonged in this course. And it was a lady from our community, elderly lady. I say that because I was younger then. I'm approaching her age now. So at the time, she was older. And she talked about what it was like to live with a family member, her son, who had schizophrenia. And she was a single parent. Her husband had passed away. And this is an adult child. And when she was up there telling her story to a group of these officers, total strangers, she was so soft-spoken, but you could tell she was completely authentic. She said, you know, you will never know what it's like to live with a child that has a serious mental illness. My biggest fear is that I will die before him and nobody will be there to take care of him. And I'm getting drawn into this story and I'm listening to her going, you know, she's living within his illness, you know, and why is she scared? You know, she's saying she's scared to call the police. And I'm sitting in here going, well, why are you scared of us? Like, we're not there to harm anybody. And her response was, as she was talking to the class, she goes, you know, one day one of you officers may have to show up to my house because I have nobody else to call. And Jeffrey's his name, and he's passed. And I want to tell that story here in a moment, if I may, to honor his life. But she said, you know, one of you officers might have to respond to my house. And he is very aggressive. He yells. He hates police officers, politicians, and lawyers. And there's a good chance that you might end up shooting and killing my son. But it's what she said next, Chris, that changed my entire career path. She said, but you know, if that happens, it's okay. Because you have a family to go home to that you love very much. And I wouldn't want you, you know, to hesitate. Wow. And that just broke me. That broke me to my core when she said that. So I waited until after the class was over and I approached her and I said, you know, Miss Janine, I heard what you said. There's power in story. You have my full attention now. But why would you say that it's okay for an officer to shoot and kill your son? And she said, what other options do you think are going to happen, Ernie? Like, what? And besides, what are you going to do about it? Now, for those that are in law enforcement that are listening to this episode right now, if you're ever challenged by something with this type of personality that it takes to be in law enforcement, you normally will rise to the occasion. Somebody challenges you to something, you're like, all right, let me show you I can do something. Well, she challenged me. Like, what am I going to do about it? My answer was very simple. I don't know, but I'm going to do something. And she was there as a representative for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So that Monday morning, well, first of all, the rest of the week, I took extremely serious and put forth 110% effort. But on Monday morning, I joined the National Alliance on Mental Illness and was a member for years and became a board of director here in San Antonio.
I think one of the things that, and if I can kind of piggyback on it, I did not get a chance to go to this training until 5 years ago. And just like you, and I wish I had known about it earlier, or somebody had opened that up to me earlier, because you know what it's like. I mean, you've been there, and officers who are listening to this, and you know it. You go to these calls all the time, and you know something's wrong, and you know that there's this person is just not acting right. This is not somebody who needs to be treated like a criminal. However, they're exhibiting things that sometimes just may, quite honestly, be a threat to your life. And unfortunately, some of these officers who maybe have had didn't have this training before, they only know one way to deal with it. It's the use of force, and the use of force on how do I protect myself to go home. They weren't taught that. So I think that one of the biggest things in having you here today is I think this is very important. I think that the NAMI crisis intervention team training is so important for officers. We have a standing policy that I put in place that within 3 years of an officer coming out of the academy, because they don't get a whole lot of training. They No. might be lucky to get 8 hours. And they don't get training on, there's so many types of mental illnesses, so many different things that can be exhibited that you can't be prepared for them all.
Yeah, no. And like you said, you know, things seem to fall back on use of force. And when you don't have the proper training and all you have is a hammer, right? Everything's a nail, the old cliche. And there's nothing worse than that feeling of, man, I feel like useless in this situation. You know, if you're an officer and you've responded to a very serious injury, maybe a shooting, a major accident, and there's a civilian, an individual that needs immediate medical care, like you don't have the tools. You just don't have the tools to be able to immediately go into action. You know some very minor basic first aid, right? But the tools you need, you know, you've got to go to specialized training to get that and then carry that type of equipment with you. So for me, it was standing around saying, I really don't know what to do, and I feel useless in this situation, just like responding to one of these traumatic incidents where family members are saying, hey, do something. And there's nothing worse than saying, you know, the ambulance is on the way, the paramedics will be here any minute, and just standing there. It's a gut-wrenching feeling, and it's not fair to you nor the community that you serve.
I want to touch on something because it always resonates with me every time I have watched Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops. It's a documentary on what you guys did in San Antonio. There is a part in the beginning that I think just smacked me in the face when I first watched it, and it was exactly what the mentality of law enforcement was. And that was your statement of saying, ask, tell, make. And I think that unfortunately, I think that sometimes that is still a process.
It is. In fact, it wasn't all that long ago that I was working as a contractor for the Department of Defense, and they still teach that method. I was teaching to the Master at Arms program, the Navy's police law enforcement program, and it was still ask, tell, make. And I'm like, man, how antiquated is this, right? Because we started with that, and then we transitioned to lead, listen, explain, equity, dignity, right? Which makes a lot more sense.
Right.
And you will stay out of a lot more altercations, you know, when you just change your mindset and you understand what you're dealing with. Like when you don't understand what the signs and symptoms are of somebody in a manic episode or somebody that's hearing, that's having hallucinations or delusional thoughts, right, you go on the defensive. You're like, hey, I don't recognize this, so I don't know what to do, so I need to really protect myself. Where if you know what you're dealing with, you have a response to it, and you know how to try to build rapport and de-escalate in most cases. I'm not going to say in all cases, because we know that sometimes these incidents end up in a tragic outcome.
I think that if you want to touch a little bit on how the documentary came about, and I don't want to give up too much because I've seen it, and I don't want to throw a lot of things out there, because you and your partner had a very, very good rapport with each other to also allow you to be able to learn and grow and deal with these situations. And I think that's a big key.
Yeah, and the documentary really captures that, right? Because like opposites attract, and me and Joe couldn't have been more opposite than each other. But you know, so how did this come about? Interesting. When we started a mental health unit in San Antonio, it was December 1st, 2008, and it was me and an officer, Casberg. There was just two of us for the whole city, right? Almost 2 million people. And we rode together. So it was one team for the whole city. But we started to get some local media coverage. Well, that local media coverage got out to a writer by the name of Ann Snyder, who wrote for The Atlantic. And she came out and did a ride along. And she wrote a feature called Policing with Velvet Gloves. And, you know, she got to see us responding to calls in plain clothes, in an unmarked car, taking as much time as we needed to with the individual, and then trying to figure out what's the best resource, right? What's the best going to be the best outcome to keep this individual safe and get them the treatment that they need. And that article went and was seen by ABC News. So ABC News then came out and rode with us, and it was Byron Pitts, who was the reporter. And it was one of those, Chris, where you couldn't make up the calls. Like, the best calls in the world were coming in to capture on video. And the initial angle of the story was going to be, hey, there were some incidences where police ended up using deadly force on people in a mental health crisis. And by the time they were done riding with us for 2 days, it now changed. It's not, hey, we want to focus on how bad these outcomes are. It's, hey, look at this alternative approach and how these things can be avoided, right?
Right.
And I can remember that one of the calls we went to, it was a wounded warrior, a veteran, and she had taken an overdose. And her husband called and said, hey, I cannot get a hold of my wife. She's not answering the phone. We're separated, but I know she's going through a very difficult time. And last time I talked to her, her speech was very slurred, and I'm worried about her. So we got over there to an apartment, and she didn't answer. So we just kicked the door in, and we found her passed out in the bathroom with pill bottles everywhere, pills everywhere. And we began immediately working on her and calling for the ambulance. And, you know, like every other officer, come on, where's that siren at, you know? And then they get there, and as we're following the ambulance, the EMS unit to the hospital, Byron Pitts is he's interviewing Joe and I, and it's a great piece. If you haven't seen it, it's on YouTube. And if you look up ABC News, San Antonio Police Mental Health, you can watch this clip. It's about 7 minutes, but he says something to the fact that, you know, I saw two police officers go in, but I saw two human beings come out. And Joe said, well, that's because of the way that it affects us. And then as you're seeing the ambulance pull into the hospital, they report out that we saved her. Well, he says, you know, Ernie and Joe saved her life. Well, that was important. That tagline right there was important, because then a filmmaker from New York, Jennifer McShane, sees this news clip. And they ran it three times in 1 year, which was the most they had ever run a story because of the use of force incidents involving law enforcement and those in a mental health crisis. So I get a phone call from Jen, and she goes, hey, I'm a filmmaker from New York, and I saw your article in The Atlantic, and I saw your story on ABC News, and I want to come down and do a ride along. I'm like, sure, come on. So I'm expecting, you know, here's a filmmaker. I'm expecting a camera crew, a sound crew. Like, she shows up with a cell phone, like an iPhone. I'm like, what is this? Not knowing, I should have done my research. She is a brilliant filmmaker who has won multiple awards for her documentary work, right? Liam Neeson did her voiceover in her last documentary, right? And I'm like, who's this? Like, what is this B film like? And I remember the first call we went on was at a group home. And it was an individual that was having auditory hallucinations, and the voices were telling him to kill the house manager. So we get there, and we're talking to him outside, and, you know, he wants to smoke a cigarette. We let him smoke a cigarette. Sometimes a lot of officers have a problem with that, right? You got to pick your battles. It's like, yeah, go ahead and smoke if that helps calm you down. And we started talking to him. I'm like, well, what is your plan to kill this gentleman? He's like, well, there's knives on the property, right? And this is captured in the documentary. And you can watch it right now. It's still streaming on HBO. And he had just had a change in medication. So we're talking for a little while. And I'm like, look, you've had a change in medication. You understand about your illness. You've got a lot of insight into it. based on what you're hearing and what you're thinking, I think it's best that we get you evaluated. So why don't you ride with us, and I'll stay with you. Both of us will until you see a provider. He's like, okay, that's fine, but I'm not going to ride in the back of that car. Now, the car was really just a black SUV, no markings on it, but it did have a divider in the back.
Right.
And I said, okay. He goes, I'm not going to ride in the back. I'll ride up front. I'm like, okay, that's fine. Like, let me just pat you down for weapons. Everything's good. We'll go. So as we're getting him situated in the vehicle, the filmmaker, she grabs me by the arm and she starts pulling me backwards. She goes, hey, what are you doing? And I was like, I don't understand the question. Like, what am I doing? What? She's like, are you putting him in the front seat?
Right.
I'm like, well, yeah. She goes, why? I said, because he wants to ride in the, like, I don't know. He wants to ride in the front. And she goes, well, what if he attacks Joe? And I'm like, well, that's Joe's problem. Like, I'm good. we know what we're dealing with. Like, it's okay.
Right.
It's
right.
He's not under arrest. He didn't commit a crime. He just needs some help above our level of care that we can provide. And she's like, this would never happen in New York. So she follows us to the treatment facility, and I walk him in, and we get triaged. He sees the nurse, and then he's next in line to see the doctor. It was that quick, right? And she's like, well, I think there's a story here to be told, because I've never seen this approach nationwide. Now, I'm not saying we're the first ones to do it. She just hadn't seen it.
Right.
So when she said, I'll be back, she, like Arnold Schwarzenegger does, like, I'll be back 3 years. She came back and filmed. And she brought a film crew. She used a local crew from Austin. So they drove down and filmed. EJ Enriquez was the cinematographer, and Paul Tui did the sound. And these guys are incredible. And they filmed for 3 years. And then the film released at South by Southwest in 2019. Now, we were very, very nervous. Never been involved in a film festival. Didn't really know what to expect. So we get dressed up, and me and Joe drive up to Austin. And it, like, Chris, these are actually at legit theaters, like draft house movie theaters. And I'm like, who is going to come see, like, who's going to come see? Like,
right.
We're two white cops from Texas answering mental health calls. Where's the sexy in this? Like, so Joe and I go in, and the theater just fills up. Right. And we're sitting kind of in the middle. Nobody knows who we are. We're nobodies. And I'm like, what if they start walking out? And, you know, here they are eating popcorn and drinking soda. I'm like, this is unbelievable. And so they're watching the documentary, and they're laughing at the funny parts. They're gasping at the serious parts.
Right.
And then when it was over, they said, hey, we have a couple of special guests here to do a question and answer. So they called me and Joe up to the front and had some chairs for us. And they gave us a standing ovation. The theater was sold out. We had two more screenings while in Austin that week. The film festival is actually a week long because it includes music and art and other things. Very big festival. And both other screenings sold out, same response, standing ovations. And the thing that we kept hearing was something very interesting, Chris. They said, you know, the people that came to watch the film, total strangers, but within 96 minutes of the completion of the film, and by the time we walked up there, they were telling us their most intimate stories about, hey, if Ernie and Joe would have responded in my house, I get emotional, man. My daughter wouldn't have hung herself, or my son wouldn't have shot himself, or my wife wouldn't have taken an overdose. And we kept hearing this over and over, and it was so powerful. And I missed it. You know, I was looking at the film going, why do I sound like that? And Joe's like, why am I so fat? And we're missing like the true essence of what the film was bringing out. And man, it was powerful. And so the film won at the film festival. It won Empathy and Craft. And we didn't know what that meant. We had already left to come back to San Antonio. And we got a phone call from Jen and the Toby Shimon, who did the editing, who won an Emmy on the film. They called and said, hey, we just won this festival. And I'm like, oh, well, yay, congratulations. She's like, no, guys, you don't understand. Like, y'all need to go buy some nice clothes. And I'm like, looking at my, I'm like, I had nice clothes. Are we? She goes, go buy some nice clothes, because we're going to go on a film festival for about the next 10 months. And it was just a whirlwind. It was a whirlwind. Wherever we went, it won. And then HBO purchased the film.
Well, I think the greatest thing, and the reason that I wanted to bring that up, Ernie, I see you get emotional about, because these are things you deal with. I want people to realize that one of the biggest things in our profession is there are individuals like yourself, people that do this job who really want to learn to be help individuals and learn how to help them. I mean, we see all the stuff, and I don't really want to get into the crap that they show 15 million times on television. But the documentary is something, if you have not watched this, if you are brand new to being a first responder, not just law enforcement, just a first responder, to watch this and see the things that you can impact just by learning and by having empathy and taking the time to not get in that mindset that you're just answering another call.
Yeah. I mean, for the longest time, you know, I worked traffic, I worked gang, I worked all the units, you know, that you want to get into as an officer. You know, I used to always say, you know, sorry, I'm just doing my job. And that is one of the most inconsiderate things I think that you can say to somebody. And I realized it one day when somebody said it to me,
right.
When somebody came to my house and needed to turn off my gas due to a small leak in the dead of winter. And I'm like, hey, man, you can't do that. Like, hold on. And then I'm just doing my job. And then I heard myself. That was me. I was saying that to people. And we need to be better than that in this profession. We truly need to be empathetic and put ourselves really in this person's position. And not what would we do in their position, but how can we support them in what they want to do in this position? I think once we learn that and we focus on the person and not the problem, right? Because the problem's emotionally charged. But if we focus on the person, that's where true human connection is made. And I think that's where you have these positive outcomes when you have these kind of trainings and specialized units that are responding to these types of crisis calls.
Exactly. And I think coming out of that, like you guys were, and while you may say that you probably weren't the first ones, but you were the first ones to kind of put it on the map. I mean, let's be honest with that. People came to San Antonio, and that's what brought this out. It's not like they haven't been doing it. And, you know, luckily, we have become a law enforcement or first responder generation that we want to learn. That this is becoming something that's at the forefront of learning and how to deal with all the different, you know, mental health issues that are out there, and being better at identifying that it is a mental health issue that we're dealing with here, and not jumping to that conclusion. Just like you said, you know, you're going to have outcomes that you're just not going to be able to control. But being able to have that foresight with this training and learning, now you can stop that tragic ending for more things than not. And I think that's the biggest point.
Well, yeah, you know, and I used to say, Chris, that CIT is the future of policing, but, you know, that was years ago. If you're not doing CIT training now, you're stuck in the past, because what law enforcement has done, those that have truly embraced this concept of crisis intervention training and alternative responses, is they've redefined what safety is, right? It's no longer the absence of crime, but the presence of well-being. And that resonates within the walls of law enforcement, because if we look in the mirror for a second, is this profession not the profession that has the most suicides every single year after year after year after year? And why is that, right? So I like that law enforcement has finally pushed this to the forefront and taken a good look at themselves in the mirror and saying, how do we build out a culture of wellness, for our own organization? Because these officers are expected to be at their best when they go out to serve the community.
Right. And I think that goes back to what you're saying, is we have the mental wellness within our own organizations. That actually helps you and helps our officers to have that empathy, to go that extra mile when they are out on the street and dealing with something. And they have more of a response to that, and knowing, let me just slow down and take my time and figure this out.
Well, you know, you being in a leadership position, I'm sure you've heard the criticism from rank and file at other agencies. You know, it's, do you feel supported by your agency?
Right.
You know, if you had to ask for help, and, you know, 9 out of 10 times you're going to be officers like, I'm not asking for help. Are you? No way. Because here's what's going to happen. You know, and it's like, we've got to get, like, the stigma attached to mental health is what's crippling this profession. It truly is. And if we turn the tables now and look on the outside and think about the community that we're serving, you know, we're so focused in on mental health, but we also have to understand that a lot of these issues that involve mental health also are co-occurring disorders, right, where you see substance use involved too. And we can't forget about that population because they're extremely vulnerable and there are limited resources, especially when it comes to money and treatment for individuals. So we've got to do a good job at training these officers, embracing these concepts, and letting that resonate back out onto the community. The documentary really, it touches on so many things, right? It shows us collaborating with our local mental health authority. It shows clinicians riding with us and responding to community members. It shows training that's going on when we hold a training. There's so much, I think, that can be captured and taken away from the documentary that we could talk about this all day long.
Right.
You know, what I feel also that is so vitally important is as we work at becoming a profession, you know, because I get, you know, law enforcement's really taken a beating over the last few years. It truly has. Some of it's well-deserved, but some of it's not. Some of it is just vicarious trauma because of things that have happened, right? But this is a very noble profession. And I think now we're at a crossroads where we're trying to find an opportunity to reconnect with the community. And what better way to do it than to partner with the community with programs like co-responder programs, community responder programs, and work together for the wellness of your community. And crisis intervention training really provides that opportunity.
Exactly. You just kind of went right to where we want to go. And that's just it. I know almost every state, and you'd be able to speak to this better because I know you have a relationship with NAMI. And I know you were just at their conference recently. And you work close with NAMI. They're actually getting ready to put together a advanced version of the training, which is important. And it's nice that they came up with this and they're getting ready to start that out. Just reach out to NAMI in your state because I'm sure they're doing it. I'm sure they're doing it.
You know, what's interesting is, so when I was at the NAMI conference, I actually co-presented with Newcastle, Delaware, and got to talk to them and their programs on deflection and diversion. And, you know, same thing. They have a NAMI coordinated CIT training. So I love that, right? Because ours in San Antonio was officer-led, community-supported, right? So the training, all the curriculum, everything was written by the officers or the subject matter experts, but it was supported by the community. NAMI would come in, provide speakers, resources. They would be on a panel. They were a huge part of it. What was very unique about our mental health unit in San Antonio was the selection of the officers. You know, if you've ever tried to transfer into a unit, you usually have to go do an interview with a supervisor or a panel of supervisors. And it really depends on how much have you shown your face around that unit, how well are you known, what is your work ethic like? Well, in San Antonio, the panel for the mental health unit consisted of the supervisors of the unit, as well as a representative from the local mental health authority and a representative from NAMI.
Awesome.
Now, imagine that. You've got civilians handpicking the officers that they want to respond to their community, to their homes. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it because they got to at the heart of the issue. They knew if you were there because you wanted to wear plain clothes or have weekends off, because they really test. Yeah, they wanted to know why is your heart in this?
Right.
What is your calling to this? You know, why are you truly here and what can you do for our community? And it was great to be a part of that process.
That's awesome. I learned a lot. I do have to come back and go, you know, there's other things that we do in working with other entities, and we have to do that. This is just not on the police officers. You know, you're dealing with mental health facilities. You're trying to deal with clinicians. I know we had tried for a while here to, you know, have a mobile crisis unit to kind of help with the police officers. And yeah, it worked for a little bit, but then it kind of died out. And it left things back on the police officers.
Yeah, in fact, what you just described is not unique, right? In San Antonio, we had a horrible relationship with our local mental health authority. In fact, if you got a call for a crisis and you had to take somebody in involuntarily in for an assessment and you went to the local mental health authority, they would take the information, then they would send you out for medical clearance at our county hospital, which you might be relieved by another officer by the time that happened, right, just to bring the individual back to show that they've been medically cleared, only to be told, now take the patient to this facility over here that has a bed. Right. It would take your entire shift. So what do you think was happening to this vulnerable population, yeah, right? They were either given no services, they were being incarcerated because of their illness, and I'm going to say it because it's true and it's happened, or worse, right? It was a horrible setup, and it wasn't until some new administration came in to the local mental health authority and said, hey, we're going to make law enforcement our priority. We're going to build a stabilization unit. It's going to be a 30-minute drop-off spot. We're going to build minor medical clearance, no longer having to go to the hospital. We're going to have a sobering and a detox center so you don't have to take these individuals that are intoxicated to jail anymore. And let me tell you what, they stepped up and they built the facility. I helped them with the design of, hey, when an officer pulls in, what's the best place for signage? Where should they park? Where should cameras be? Things like that that they wouldn't have thought of. And it was an amazing collaboration. And everybody comes to Bexar County now and is like, hey, how did y'all do it? You know, and it's like, we weren't an overnight success. Like it took 17 years to really solidify a great program here in San Antonio. So it takes time, but you've got to have leaders that are committed to the vision.
I think it's and like you said, it's important to touch on that, because it's not like, hey, let's snap our fingers, this works great. You know, it takes work. It takes a lot of hard work. And it takes in organizations like NAMI, it takes leadership to send their people to these things. And it takes the officers kind of buying in and seeing, you know, that this works. A lot of times, you know, you're going to, and I'm going to get to another part of what I wanted to talk to you about today, is you're de-escalating these situations by helping this person. Like, you are taking that time instead of getting to that ask, tell, make mentality. You're giving it that time to actually de-escalate that situation and get this person to where they need to go a lot of times. Like, yeah, they just want someone to talk to.
Yeah, and you, somebody to listen to them, right? Yes. Which is exactly what you said. Because when you look at it, one of the foundation courses to crisis intervention training is active listening. In fact, I wrote a book on mental de-escalation, mental health de-escalation, right? And it's kind of an outline course of crisis intervention training. And if you look at the active listening portion of the training, of the 7 active listening skills, only one really requires asking questions, right? The rest of it is, are you clarifying content? Are you pausing instead of trying to step in? And are you reflecting some of these statements that are coming to you, right? We use the FBI's active listening model and implemented it into the training with San Antonio. And, you know, when the officers do their role plays, they immediately go into that question answer. Right. So I tell them, okay, question answers off the table. Use the 6 other active listening skills. Right. And it's like pulling teeth. But by the time the week is over, it's like they don't even start asking questions till they've built a rapport and there's some empathy. And the role player is like, yeah, I can connect with this officer. They took the time to understand me and to see why I'm frustrated. They validated my feelings. And they said things like, you know, I would feel frustrated too if that happened to me, right? These little statements like that is what builds rapport. And then they start asking the problems, the, you know, problem solving questions and, you know, how are we going to, you know, wrap this up and make sure that you've got proper care and treatment.
Great. So your book, Mental Health and De-Escalation, it's out there and available. So I encourage everybody, I mean, not trying to sell Ernie's book here, but but I think that you're getting, as you're listening to this podcast, you're seeing that you're getting information from an individual who's been there and done that and had the passion to do it the right way, along with the other individuals that were in his unit.
Yeah, it was a fun experience writing the book. I'm definitely not an expert when it comes to writing a book. In fact, my co-author, Nick Ruggiero, I give him a lot of credit. He had written a lot of books, and he called me one day, said, hey, do you want to co-author a book? And I'm like, yeah, sure. What do you want to do it on? He goes, well, I don't know. How about homicide? I'm like, homicide? I don't know. I mean, I've worked some homicides, but I was never like a homicide detective. And then I'm like, well, what about mental health? And he's like, damn, man, sorry, I forgot who I was talking to. He goes, yeah, let's do that. So he was a sergeant in Virginia. So he goes, the deal was, hey, we're each going to write 50 pages. We're not going to talk about what we're going to write about. You write yours, I'll write mine, then we'll compare notes. Well, we ended up both getting COVID at the same time. So I'm like, I'll just start writing my portion out. Got nothing else to do. So I started writing it really from a practitioner standpoint, right? Everything from in the beginning is where my chapter starts. In the beginning, a little background and history of myself, but then really dive into the training, right? The core foundational courses that are in there, right? Active listening, crisis response, de-escalation. I even put a chapter in there on EMTALA. And if officers don't know what the Emergency Medical Treatment Active Labor Act is, I suggest you learn about that, because you're going to learn that, you know, where I used to go to a facility with a patient and they'd be like, well, what kind of insurance they got? I'm like, I don't know. They're unfunded. Oh, well, then you have to leave and go to another facility. You have to go to the county hospital. I'm like, oh, okay. Not knowing that that's an EMTALA violation. And I'm putting this patient back in my car and traveling 30 miles to another facility, right? So I took numerous classes on EMTALA, and I felt that was an important class to put in there. And it's not so police can walk into a hospital and say, hey, here's a patient, EMTALA, I'm out, right? It was, hey, we need to work together. I know the rights of not only the patient, right? Because EMTALA really is about the rights of the patient, but also to let the hospital facilities know, hey, I we're not here to enforce your policy, right? We're here to make sure that the patient is protected and that we have transferred this patient to a higher level of care. And once we've done that, our responsibility is done, right? So I put a chapter in there about that and some other stuff. And what was very interesting about it was when we released the book, it went number one in a week. Like, and we didn't do anything to mess with the, you know, a lot of, I have found that a lot of authors kind of mess with the metrics on these. You know, they buy a whole bunch of copies within 15 minutes to try to, like, I didn't do any of that. Didn't even know about that. I get a phone call from Nick saying, hey, the book is selling. Like, it's moving quick. And I'm like, who's buying this thing, right? And then we're getting reviews and I'm getting emails saying, hey, I'm a paramedic, or I'm a single mom with a daughter that has bipolar. And I didn't know, but I do now. Like, this chapter helped explain this behavior. Hospital facility, like, so many different people were buying it. And now we've had over 225 different law enforcement agencies purchase this book and either hand it out to their officers or put it in their libraries and make it accessible to them. So it was an amazing opportunity to be able to do that. It's an easy read for officers, and it's a good resource that they can stick in their bag and, you know, just read when they have a, you know, a few minutes, just read 4, 5, 6 pages at a time. And it's not very long. It's 120, 130 pages. And there's some good information in there, I think, that'll sharpen your skills.
Awesome. We could talk forever about this stuff, man, because I know I could, because I can learn a lot from you, and I know that I will probably watch the documentary again. I've already seen it twice. So right. I always pick up, it's like anything else. You watch a movie, you watch it again, you pick up stuff you didn't see before. But I think my last question for you, Ernie, and I thank you for taking all this time, is if you had one last thing to say regarding your history with bringing up the mental health issue and dealing with it and being a big part of that in San Antonio, what would you tell the newer officers today? What is the important part of all that?
Yeah, don't enter this career field with a fixed mindset that you've learned everything you're going to learn in the academy, right? Or it's dangerous. You've got to be willing to have a growth mindset, to embrace opportunities that you didn't think were going to add any value or benefit, right? I'm a prime example of that. I tried everything I could to get out of that training. Thank God I attended that training. Thank you, Lord, for that opportunity that I was able to sit there and listen to family members and listen to different doctors and nurses and learn the laws in Texas about when I could do an involuntary commitment. I truly still didn't understand the laws completely. So be willing to have a growth mindset. And that's throughout your entire career as a law enforcement officer. Don't get stuck under that umbrella of, you know, I'm tough, I'm strong, I don't need to ask for help, I'm expected to have bad days, I just got to deal with it. That's a fixed mindset. Be willing to grow. be willing to say it's okay not to be okay. It's just not okay to stay that way. You know, I would encourage you, you know, if you haven't watched the documentary, watch it. Reach out to me. Give me your feedback. I love that, Chris, you've used your platform for this episode to address mental health and the intersection of criminal justice. It is vitally important that people continue to hear this message, and you've provided that. So it's been an honor to be a guest on your show, and I'm so grateful and thankful for the opportunity to even talk to you today.
Well, I thank you, my friend. Thank you, Ernie. I appreciate your time. I hope to see you again soon down the road, and I wish you the best.
My pleasure. Let's do it again soon.
You got it. Take care.
Likewise.
You've been listening to the Deep Blue Project. As a father, husband, friend, and someone who loves to chat about anything and everything, Chris brings over 3 decades of public service experience to the table. With a background in firefighting and law enforcement, along with degrees in criminal justice and behavioral science, he's seen it all, and he's learned a thing or two along the way. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, make sure to like, rate, and review. We'll be back soon. But in the meantime, find us on LinkedIn and X at Deep Blue Project. Find our website at deepblueproject.com. And to reach out, send an email to deepblueproject@outlook.com. Keep keeping it real. And we'll see you next time on the Deep Blue Project.